Chapter 39. July AD 2066. Year 10, ERC, Winter. After a flight across the North Sea from the mainland to New Aberdeen, without any problems as far as Tash could tell, the RAF helicopter smoothly began its descent. The bird itself had been heavily modified since Tash had last taken a ride, with very obvious ash screening filters over the engine inlets and what appeared to be robust supplementary armour layered over the outer hull. In the cabin, a peculiar webbing was embedded in the interior walls. Grace called it a Faraday cage, a new shell of protection against beamed cyber attacks. And as they flew, they had been accompanied by a swarm of spotter and missile-carrying drones. Tash had the sense of a watchful infrastructure, from satellites overhead to warships in the ocean. And, she could see as they descended, human sentries on the Middle Sea dams. 3 years on from Naples, with the volcano's aftermath still unravelling, it had been the single worst post-blink disaster by far. The world was an introverted, paranoid place, crisscrossed by refugee flows, marred by low-level conflict. Hungry, cold, and sick. It was, in longer memories, such as her father's, like a throwback to the crisis years of the 2030s, when the great powers eyed a failing world and each other. Which, Tash knew, was a key subtext to this latest conference on Galaxias and all its works. Or so she supposed. She had been kept in the dark, excluded subtly even by Fred Bowles, more than she was used to. She knew the surface objectives were scientific and diplomatic, or at least she inferred that Fred hoped so, in his usual consensus-building, bridge-crossing fashion. After all, he had already achieved the major coup of persuading the Chinese government to send a delegation led by Wu Yan, in the hope, presumably, of getting them to talk at last about whatever they were doing on Mercury, 7 years after the first landings on the planet. And speaking of introversion, paranoia, and being kept in the dark, Tash had got barely a word out of Grace during the flight, even though they sat together for the whole crossing, just ahead of Charlie Marlowe and a couple of rows behind Bowles, their boss. Grace had self-evidently never recovered from the loss of her sister and niece in the aftermath of Naples. It didn't help, Tash supposed, that almost every minute of every day she did her job, Grace was reminded of those losses. Grace kept keeping on, Tash saw, for now, anyhow. But even so, Tash found herself becoming, reluctantly, ever more wary of Grace and her moods. Grace and her increasingly furtive, taciturn ways. She and Grace had worked together for 10 years already, and all the way through the blink, and yet it felt as if they were growing further apart, not closer. Tash was, in fact, suspicious of Grace, though she couldn't have said specifically why. A distant boss with an agenda he wouldn't or couldn't share, an unreliable, scary colleague at her side. Everything seemed to be fraying. She wished she had someone to talk to about it. Ideally Mel or Xi, she supposed. But right now Xi was still nearly 200 astronomical units out in space, in a Pioneer 14 spacecraft slowly developing into a permanent station, its new purpose to observe the enigmatic artifacts of Galaxias, if that was what those remote negative gravity structures were. And Marlowe herself had apologised to Tash, as they had boarded the chopper for the absence of Mel, who was working back at Boldershaw Fell. I couldn't spare her. Too much stuff back at the ranch, especially since we had that anti-science crazies petrol bomb attack. Well, where Grace was concerned, Tash resolved to stay wary, but to try not to brood. And she would do her best to support Fred Bowles any way she could, trusting him, even if he didn't feel he was able to trust her. The pilot called the landing. Tash sat back, pulled on her ash filter face mask, and peered out of the window at the approaching conference centre. Again. As soon as the chopper had landed on the conference centre roof, Grace and another couple of military guards, Marines, anonymous behind masks, clambered out to lead the party across the landing pad to elevators down to the interior floors. A new feature since Tasha's last visit was a gaudy spire that thrust up from the centre of the roof. Tash clambered out behind Marlowe and Bowles. They were greeted by a harsh, cold, damp wind, peppered with what felt like sleet to Tash as it battered her face. This was July, but such was the drift of the calendar by now that it was a seasonal winter, as correctly mapped by Kane's new regularised calendar. But there was some spectacle out here. Tash saw now that the ugly spire, probably a mask for an antenna complex, actually rotated, revealing a huge banner draped from one flank. England World Cup 1966, Centenary Celebration. The words were set against a shifting, dissolving montage of images of young men in red sport shirts, cheering and laughing, set in brilliant sunshine. Marlowe essayed. Soccer players? Bowles nodded. I take it you don't know the game, Charlie? Tash shrugged. Nor me. Not really. My dad has mentioned it. Minority sport now, but all the rage 100 years back. One of the great mass spectacles we don't do anymore. And it gave an English team possibly its finest sporting moment. So some history books say. We were planning to host a large-scale event this summer to mark the centenary. Maybe recreate the final with holograms, even robots. Marlowe grinned, another of Mara Kane's quasi-patriotic stunts, which of course will only repel the Scots and Welsh and Irish she wants to draw back into the old British Union. Well, Naples put a stop to that. Fred gestured at an immense banner. I went along with the display, though. I thought we should throw up everything we have to make this latest symposium as memorable as we could. As symbolic, as significant, colourful. There's always an anniversary if you look hard enough. Every little helps, I guess, Tash said. He grinned rueful. Well, you know me by now. But of course, it's also a reminder that we don't get sunny July days like that anymore. He sounded tired. Marlowe said gently, they even abolished July. Tash felt tired. She would be 40 the following year. We're all getting old, she thought. She looked again at the football players, holding aloft their golden trophy on what looked like an unfeasibly sunny summer afternoon. Some part of her longed to be there, back then, in 1966. They were approaching the elevator doors now. Tash tried to focus. She saw that among the military types waiting was Harry Regent, a surprising sight. He stood out in his blue USAF uniform among the English Marines and detachments of English and Scottish police. As she walked up, following Marlowe and Bowles, Tash clearly saw Regent and Butterworth nod to each other, then prepared to walk side by side in the vanguard of Fred's escort. And they shook hands. Just briefly, it was over in a second, but they had done it. That startled Tash. In the post-blink, post-Naples world, you avoided physical contact instinctively. Plagues and pandemics were afoot, even some weaponized. And, from a security point of view, it wasn't impossible to pass data genetically encoded in droplets of sweat, blood. You didn't touch people, however innocently. Certainly not in circumstances like these, not without massive precautions. Could she have been mistaken? No, come on, Tash. Here were two military officers, or in Grace's case, ex-military, and they'd shaken hands, bare skin, palm to palm. And in the open, as soon as they met, as if they feared they might not get another chance. What the hell might that mean? Not for the first time, Tash wished Mel were here, or G, somebody she could talk to, implicitly trusting, because she felt a cold, hard knot of suspicion coagulate deep inside. In fact, she wondered if she should talk to someone, a Marine, one of the civilian police who stood back from the group as they passed, even Fred himself. But she was aware of one senior copper, a burly middle-aged man, a superintendent, she thought, suspiciously watching her hesitate. She hurried on. They reached the opening elevator doors. More officials came swarming out to cluster around Fred and his entourage. They had to line up to be scanned, each giving that day's verbal security code, 3141, and the moment was lost. As soon as she was inside the building, Tasha's phone vibrated in her pocket. A curt message from Fred, evidently preset for the moment of landing. 30 minutes comfort break, then Office 3A. She swung by her own room, dumped her small pack, used the bathroom, spent 5 minutes on yoga moves to work the flight out of her stiff body, changed. Tash knew 3A well by now. It was one of Fred's favourite spots, deep within the bowels of the centre. Once he had explained his rationale to her. Remote enough from the main public areas to be private, physically, super secure, screened from signals save through a single fibre. That speaks to just one phone that you'll be carrying, Tash. A single door, easy to secure. In quieter days, it's officially a rehearsal room for presenters, so it has all the AV virtual facilities you could need. Great place for people to talk, even if you have to force them to do so. Oh, and thanks to Grace, one of the best coffee machines in the building. Yes, Tash thought moodily now. Thanks to Grace, who might now have other things on her mind than her boss's caffeine intake. Again confused, distracted, and vaguely suspicious, she put the thought aside. She collected her stuff, including that security-issue phone, and was at 3A within 20 minutes of Fred's 30. Grace was already there, sitting outside the door, a basic security setup. Tash knew the current protocols, systems of layers upon layers, shells of alert attention surrounding people like bowls, including simply somebody sitting outside the room he was in. Grace didn't acknowledge Tash, but then she wasn't supposed to when the protocols applied. At least there was no sign of the increasingly sinister Harry Regent, Tash thought. But when she walked into the conference room itself, she was surprised by the attendees. Aside from Grace, the token security seated outside the door, and Tash herself as more or less a note-taker and formal witness, the government's rules were still that all official or semi-official encounters of government ministers with foreign nationals had to be witnessed. The only players were Fred Bowles himself, Astronomer Royal Charlie Marlowe, and Wu Yan. "You're late," Fred waved Tash to a seat. She wasn't. "Sorry, sir." She glanced at her phone. "Your room authentication code, sir. 5926. An extra minister-level layer of security, with additional protection at each scheduled locale the minister visited. But before she could sit, Yan stood, turned, and approached Tash. Yan was aging too, Tash thought. She looked tired, careworn. But still she stood tall and proud, folded in a long, characteristically sombre brown robe. She was like a Chinese treasure ship, Tash thought, magnificent and dignified. Her face worked as she came to Tash and held her two hands. "It's so good to see you, even in this circumstance." That last clause puzzled Tash. Yan smelled, Tash thought, of some rare exotic flower. "And you, I..." Yan let her go and put her finger to Tash's lips. "I know. I miss him too. I think of him every day, every minute. But there isn't the bandwidth for much messaging, especially imagery from the Pioneer. Little to spare for anything non-essential so far away. So I relish the messages you share with me, your friend Melissa too." Tash smiled. "He'll come home someday." "Oh, I know. He has travelled far before, and has always come back. The trick, I believe, is not to let him know how much he is missed." "I think he knows." "Please," Fred snapped out the word. Then, clearly uncomfortable, he forced a smile. "Please sit. I'm sorry, we don't have much time." Yan stepped back from Tash and sat. And she said, sounding sad to Tash's ears, "Not much time before you hand me over. Well, who to? Your police? MI6? I am a foreign national. The Fizz police, perhaps." Tash just stared, bewildered. Yan looked back at her and evidently took pity. "You don't know, do you, Tash? My presence here is not voluntary. I was urged to come here to... well, to contribute to yet another of Mr. Bowles's very worthy conferences. That was false pretenses. Instead, I was arrested as soon as I landed." Charlie Marlowe spoke for the first time since Tash had walked in.
Arrested? What outrage is this?
Tash, baffled herself, thought Bowles looked embarrassed, even distressed, but determined.
I'm sorry for the subterfuge, Bowles said. The formal arrest wasn't my idea, believe me. We can spin it as diplomatic immunity. We can say we are protecting you from the fizz cops and your own people, but we must talk.
Yan asked him seriously.
You are afraid, aren't you?
Afraid enough to do such a thing.
What is it you fear?
Bowles looked at her frankly.
The number one scenario, worst case right now, a Russia-China war.
He held Yan's gaze. She said,
I know little officially, nor probably should I comment, but it is not a hard extrapolation to make, given the state of international politics. The refugee flows we have already intercepted heading south from the Russian north.
Marlowe grunted, given the state of the world, I doubt any such war would end until we are reduced to throwing chunks of shattered masonry at each other's heads.
But why go to these extremes now, Fred?
Bowles eyed her bleakly.
Charlie, it's Mercury. There are suspicions, which I know are running round in government circles in Russia, probably elsewhere. He grunted.
Security is so tight I sometimes think I know more about what the Russians are thinking than I do about the Americans.
Or the English, my own bosses.
The Chinese have evidently turned Mercury into some kind of vast, swarming industrial complex, right?
Well, to what end?
There's one very plausible, very paranoid theory that it's got nothing to do with Galaxias at all. I'm no scientist, I'm a politician. And to a politician, the simplest hypothesis is weapons. Maybe Mercury is being turned into one giant weapons factory.
All that sunlight energy, all those rich minerals,
hell. You all know this stuff far better than me.
He glared around the room.
Can't you see, Charlie?
That's the way the Russians are thinking. What if it's all a cover-up? Layers and layers of lies.
Well, it wouldn't be the first time.
Even if Galaxias exists as we understand it, what if Mercury is all about developing some kind of weapon aimed at a terrestrial foe?
At Russia?
He pointed at Yan.
I won't put up with blanket denials anymore. We know some of those replicator machines of yours have already lifted off the surface of the planet.
Yan smiled, almost tiredly.
That is true. They are leaving the planet, but not heading for Earth.
The trouble is, you're evidently at a stage where you can't hide what you're doing anymore.
Well, that's been true since you started dismantling the damn planet. And nobody can stop you, anyhow, right?
Yan was frowning.
What is it specifically that you want of me, here and now? What must I do to earn my release?
That's easy, Bowles leaned forward. I want you to tell us what you are doing.
Finally, Charlie's here to help me understand. Tell me. Tell us now, because I want to help you sell it.
He sat back. I want to believe your motives are reasonable, whatever the hell you're doing. So I'm forcing you, Yan, as best I can, to share it with us here and now. And then maybe, just maybe, we can stop this from pushing us all into some stupid, unintended war.
Marlowe grunted. While Galaxias laughs, probably.
Yan eyed Bowles.
Do you have your Prime Minister's backing for this action?
Bowles laughed hollowly.
What do you think? Oh, Mara wants to do something about China's weapons program, all right. Her idea of the precedent to avoid is the failure to stop Hitler's military build-up before the Second World War. We could end up going to war over suspicions, Yan. But she also wants plausible deniability if all this goes belly up. So I'm out on a limb here. And if this goes wrong, well, given the bigger picture, that won't really matter, I guess.
The hell with it.
He folded his arms.
Tell me or not. That's my pitch.
Oh, if you refuse, I'll let you out of here and you can do as you like.
The arrest is all a bluff.
It's just that it's our last chance.
Possibly. Probably.
Wu Yan sat quietly for a while. Then she looked from Bowles to Marlowe and over her shoulder at Tash.
Tash thought everybody was holding their breath. Was this a pivot of history? Would people in the future look back on what was happening in this room, just as Fred had implied, like the failed diplomacies before the great wars of the 20th century? And Jan smiled. Not a bad strategy, Fred. And actually, the idea of breaking a few rules appeals to me. I may not look it, and my son would never believe it, but I was somewhat reckless in my youth. That was when Tasha's phone vibrated in her pocket. Fred looked at her sharply. The phone was the mandatory security issue, the only phone in the room open to incoming calls or data via that one fibre channel. With a whispered apology, she dug out the phone on mute, glanced at the message, put down the phone. Fred was watching her. The others waited. She tried to think, to take in what she'd just learned. This was way above her pay grade. Fred prompted, "Natasha? There's a report of an explosion. On the moon." The others exchanged glances. Then the door opened, Grace Butterworth walked in and sat on a chair opposite Wu Yan. Tash was utterly bewildered. A bomb on the moon. And now Grace, breaking basic security protocols. At least, Tash saw, she carried no firearm. Her holster was empty. The room itself wouldn't have let her in otherwise. But she shouldn't be in here. Tash glared at her. Grace, what the hell? Grace just looked back. Special measures. What special measures? Fred snapped. Where on the moon? Speak up, Brand. We can deal with Grace later. She blurted, in the Sinus Medii, that's all I have, in the Monument Park. The others exchanged glances. The Monument Park, said Marlowe, the area around the lurker, so if it's deliberate. An unfounded assumption, Wu Yan said. So far, maybe, said Marlowe dryly. I imagine accidental explosions on the moon are pretty rare. And if not accidental, if this was deliberate, who was the perpetrator? A glance at Tash. Casualties? What damage is there? What was the target? She took a breath. Was it the lurker? Tash glanced at her phone again. I've got no more than I've told you, she said. Do you want me to monitor this? Bowles sighed and said wryly, it hardly sets the tone of the meeting I hope to have here. But that's life. Keep an eye, Tash, and let us know what we need to know. Okay. You were about to break some rules, Jan, I think, just as the bomb went off. Marlowe looked at him. You're serious? You want us to keep talking in the middle of all this? Fred nodded. I've been under worse pressure. On blink day for a start. You keep working. Charlie, Jan, please. Wu Yan made a visible effort to focus, closing her eyes briefly, concentrated. If she was perturbed by the presence of Grace Butterworth opposite her, Tash recognised with some admiration she wasn't showing it. Fred was aware, though. He kept watching Grace warily, exchanging glances with Tash, evidently as confused as she was. At length, Yan said, "Very well. Consider Galaxias." If we are to deal with its presence in our lives, we must understand it. Even now, much of what we know of it is guesswork. But we do know some things. Remember, above all, Galaxias is alone. Or so we infer from what we know, or believe we know, of its physical origin on a water world. Alone, the only one of its kind. Yes, Charlie, you led the framing of this hypothesis, and we agree with you. And that shows in its actions in many ways. For instance, communications. Galaxias is one. It has never had the need to communicate with others as we do, with codes and symbols in sound, writing, electromagnetic waves. Galaxias acts, like pushing at a rock to see if it will tip over. Okay, Fred Bowles said, so Galaxias shoves our star around to see if we stop, doing whatever alarms it. He was apparently relieved to be dealing with celestial abstractions once more, Tash saw. She admired his concentration. Yes, Jan said, and be aware, by the way, that Galaxias's own origin might limit its imagination more than we understand.
Possibly transporting the sun of a water world would do less harm to any inhabitants on that world than it does to a world like ours. Marlow nodded. That's a good point, and it's been made before. A blink applied to a water world might generate one almighty global slosh, essentially harmless, rather than the crumbling of a world like ours, with a thin crust over a mantle of active liquid rock and shallow seas liable to flood the land. Doesn't help us, though, Bowles said sternly. A pretty drastic oversight. Marlow nodded, conceding the point. Galaxius was born alone, then, Yan went on. And remember, born at cosmic high noon. We believe from the lurker dating, a time when the sky was dense and bright. But since then, it has seen the universe expand and cool and dim all around, huge empty spaces in which it remains alone. Think of that. Galaxius has no defenders, nobody to watch its back, metaphorically. Only itself, alone, adrift in a dying universe, dying from its point of view, a long, drawn-out dying that Galaxius has witnessed itself. Ask yourself, how would that feel? How would it shape your psychology? So Galaxius is cautious, even paranoid, in our terms. A Crusoe stuck on his island for all eternity. Bowles thought that over. And the first thing Crusoe did was build stockades, as I recall. Okay. But is that all there is to Galaxius, Yan? Does it have any ethic beyond some brute need to survive? Possibly, Yan said. There has been some speculation on the nature of universal ethics, values that might be shared by differently embodied intelligences. Galaxius is solitary. Its own survival must be the key priority. But given that basic goal, it may have varying strategies, varying ethical principles, such as the notion of thermodynamic ethics, where you seek to maximize the value of all the free energy in the universe, or all that is left. Or, a related idea, you might seek to maximize the generation of information, of memory, of thought. Let the universe become as conscious as it can be. In the case of Galaxius, perhaps it dreams of taking all of the cosmos into its single consciousness. And if that's so, the first priority is not to waste resources, mass, energy, for these fuel galactic dreams. Bowles grunted. Galaxius doesn't seem to be aiming to maximize human consciousness at the moment. No, because it may see us, in the short term, as an obstacle to a longer-term cosmic goal in that regard, as it may have observed with other cultures previously. Marlow nodded. We spoke of this before. We briefed you, Fred. Your people, the danger of an immature culture expanding its resource usage exponentially, as we have, until it blossoms out into space, still expanding until it reaches a light-speed limit. And expansion must stop, and it all collapses, probably, in war, starvation, ripping a hole in the cosmic resource store in the process. That's it, Yan said. Galaxius may have observed this, harm, as it may see it before. And it may have a fear of its recurrence. We Chinese have a long memory. My grandparents spoke of how they were forever wary of the return of Luan, the chaos of the 20th century wars, and earlier centuries had their own chaos. Luan, Tash remembered how Mel had told her that Xi himself had used that word when briefing Li Yamanaka at the start of all this, mother and son. Marlow nodded. Which, you think, is pretty much how Galaxius feels all the time. Wu Yan shrugged, a graceful gesture, Tash thought. At least we can empathize. Galaxius is a galactic power, clearly. We cannot wish it out of existence. The Americans' pioneer is a fist waved in the face of Genghis Khan. Brave, but futile, if not deadly. No, we cannot defy. We must accommodate. And to do that, we must understand its fears. Its fears, Bowles murmured. What of our fears? Marlow said, all of which, Yan,
is a preamble to telling us what you are actually trying to do at Mercury. Well, essentially, I suppose, we intend to do what Galaxias did. Tash was baffled, which means, we intend to move the sun. There was a startled silence. Tash looked around the room. She had to laugh. Cue jaws literally dropping. Well, you got us, Jan. That was when Tasha's phone shivered again. They were all aware of it. She glanced at the phone and looked at Fred. Fred nodded to her to report. The bomb, she said now, staring into the phone. And it was a bomb, it's been confirmed. Some kind of battlefield nuke. No word yet on its origin, its manufacture, or the perpetrator. But it seems to have been a drone strike, very precise, and it did hit the lurker site. She was aware of their stares as she hastily paged through more data. No word on casualties yet. No clues to the perpetrator. Bowles frowned. Impossible. Nothing should be able to get through in that way. I was briefed on all that when we set up the British marker. The signal we send out from that monument is meant to be a pivot of a surveillance and robust network, feeding into the international shielding, unless that itself was hacked. Grace, Tash said, suddenly understanding. She stared at Butterworth, still sitting silently where she shouldn't have been. You were there, on the moon, that day, when we dedicated the monument. Weren't you, Grace, with Harry Regent? You set this up. There and then. You sabotaged the British marker, didn't you? Even though you were entrusted with the security codes themselves. And you just waited for the right moment to come around to use whatever hook you had left in it. The right moment to drop the shield. Grace didn't react. Fred Bowles looked devastated. Of course. My God, Grace, how could you? I trusted you with my life. Not just then, over and over. Suddenly it seemed to Tash he had never looked older, more worn down. 9 years since the blink in the stresses of government, and most recently years in the endless cage fight that was Mara Kane's cabinet, were taking their toll, she thought. Grace just stared ahead. Bowles seemed to pull himself together. All right. There's nothing we can do about that, sitting here. I think we should continue our discussion, this sharing. We have to focus, he said, sounding as if he was capable of anything but. Jan, please. Galaxias, what did you say? You intend to move the sun? You'd better start at the beginning. Very well. She steepled her fingers, closed her eyes, as if gathering her thoughts. We are not building a weapon, of course not. We are building a fog engine. Tash couldn't resist going to her phone, the only working device in the room, to look that up. 2 G's in fog, Jan said with a smile. I can tell you how it works, roughly, though of course this will take many generations to perfect and deploy. Many, many generations, actually, to move the sun. We do not have Galaxias's magic solar transporter technology. But it can be done, even by us, given time. It is a space-borne design. Essentially, we will manipulate the sun's own magnetosphere to turn the whole sun into a kind of rocket, a very feeble rocket, given the sun's mass. The sun will not be light-speed beamed, not by us. It will move slowly, slowly, but it will move. They sat and took that in. Tash tried to understand. What's a magnetosphere? Marlow said. The sun's magnetic field, Tash, an immense structure in its own right, rooted in the sun's physical body, created by giant flows of charged particles in its interior. And I mean immense. The planets have them too. Why, if Jupiter's magnetosphere was visible from Earth, it would be a structure 5 times larger than the full moon, she laughed, bleakly. I should say that the full moon used to be. That's it, Jan said, and she smiled. Whether you approve of what we are doing or not, you can't deny the magnificence of the endeavour. For, with our little machines, we are seeking to manipulate a structure larger than the sun itself.
Marlowe snorted.
But that's just a means to an end, correct?
Throughout these exchanges, Tash kept an eye on Grace, who didn't move a muscle, her face blank, empty. Tash was sure she wasn't hearing a single word of this fantastic scheme. Tash's awareness of Grace's multiple betrayals today was like a spike in her head.
So tell us how you will do this, Marlowe went on. How will you manipulate the magnetic field of the sun?
With an electric current,
which we will create with a ring of iron accelerators circling the sun's equator.
Particle beams. The accelerators will be positioned in a close orbit around the sun, at about 1/7 of the orbital radius of Mercury.
But that alone is a huge undertaking. How will you build so many?
Ah! Marlowe slapped the tabletop. Replication! And that was what you have been manufacturing on Mercury. You were building what we thought were tokamaks, fusion chambers, from Mercury ore.
Or bombs, Bowles murmured.
No, these will be your accelerators. Self-replicating accelerators, Yan said.
We may dismantle Mercury entirely to construct the stations we need, ultimately.
Bowles barked a laugh.
Dismantle a planet?
That's not a thought I expected to hear today. Still in the dark over here, though, chaps.
So, Yan said, let me make this clear for you.
She held up one fist above the table and sketched rough semicircles in the air with the forefinger of the other hand around the fist from top to bottom. Here is the sun. Here is the magnetosphere, the flux lines around the sun, anchored at the poles. And here is a fog engine. Now she sketched circles around the equator of her fist.
So you run a strong current through an equatorial ring of accelerators around the waist of the sun, which will create a toroidal magnetic field around the whole star, like a donut, and that will squeeze the magnetosphere.
Ah, Marlowe said. I see. And the ring of accelerators? These are your acorns, self-manufacturing on Mercury. The numbers must be
heroic, Yan said softly.
We will raise a swarm of 100 trillion machines, each massing a few thousand tons. Self-replication is rapid once it starts, but we estimate this will take no less than millennia to complete.
Bowles laughed tiredly. Oh, just millennia. Some 1/1000th of the mass of Mercury will be consumed in this first phase. Then the swarms, flocking like swallows, will fly down from Mercury to an inner close orbit, and the machines will begin their work. With powerful particle beams, they will generate immense star-girdling electric currents, which in turn will distort the sun's magnetosphere. And with that, we will manipulate the solar wind.
Ah.
Marlowe glanced at Bowles. For the benefit of the tape, that's a flow of charged particles that streams off the sun continually.
Thanks for the clarification, Bowles said dryly.
I see, said Marlowe to Yan.
And you direct that flow, presumably by firing it out of one or the other of the solar magnetic poles, and that is your rocket exhaust.
Okay, I think I have enough to do some order of magnitude figuring.
She got her own phone out, started tapping, threw it on the table.
Useless. Damn your security.
Okay, in my head. Suppose the mass flow emerges from one pole at solar escape velocity, which is a little over 600 kilometers a second. Now, I know that the mass lost to the solar wind is about 2 million tons per second. Sounds a lot, but it would, what, take 100 million years to lose a mass the equivalent of Earth. And the sun is 1/3 of a million times more than that, or so. You won't run out of propellant any time soon.
But you aren't going to get much of a push out of it, after all that work.
True, said Yan. So we increase the flow of the solar wind, our rocket exhaust.
How? By dropping bombs on the sun?
Not quite.
By heating one polar region with lasers, or possibly matter beams. We have already tested this aspect with flyby spacecraft. Flying close to the sun, that is.
Bowles frowned. You kept that quiet?
that you are already meddling with the Sun.
All relevant results will be released after the formal meeting, Yan smiled.
The program delivered good science data too. That will make you happy, Astronomer Royal.
As to the engineering, with a continuous heating process, and there will be plenty of energy to be harvested by our equatorial ring of solar energy stations, we believe we can increase the mass flow by a factor of 100,000, perhaps.
Marlowe looked faintly desperate.
100,000? Okay, let's assume you achieve that. The Sun's going to be a rocket, flying across the galaxy like some stately galleon.
Bowles asked,
and the planets? When Galaxius took the Sun, the planets were left adrift, weren't they? Will the planets be left behind?
Yan shook her head.
No. The planets are bound to the Sun gravitationally and will stay that way.
We will take the suite of planets and moons with us, and the comets, the asteroids, all save a few distant stragglers, perhaps.
Marlowe nodded. That makes sense, Fred. The Sun is already moving, following a long orbit around the centre of the galaxy. The planets stay with it as it orbits, just as the Moon stays with the Earth as it orbits the Sun.
Yan smiled.
Precisely. Why, most people won't even notice the new motion. Not until the velocity builds up, the displacement, not even visible for millennia, longer. Of course, our own estimates of performance are only guesses. We can expect the, engine itself to evolve. We have given our replicators the capacity to learn, to experiment. Perhaps we can achieve much greater efficiencies, much more powerful magnetic fields. For instance, particle flows energetic enough to emulate conditions after the Big Bang, when the fundamental forces were still unified, gravity and quantum forces.
Marlowe frowned.
Only just after the Big Bang, a trillionth of a trillionth of a trillionth of a second. Our best current guess as to how to achieve that is to build a photon-photon collider, with a length comparable to the width of Jupiter's orbit and absorbing, say, 10% of the Sun's luminosity. No doubt there are more efficient designs, but if you could achieve that, the magnetic fields available to manipulate the Sun.
Let's leave that for the future, Bowles said dryly. Can we stick to what you can actually foresee?
So you're pushing the Sun,
and for millennia, you're hinting.
Pushing it where?
Marlowe said,
no, let me try to figure it out.
A check on the logic.
So let's use the rocket equation. We know the rate of mass loss. We know the exhaust velocity.
What would make a significant difference to our position? Suppose we want to emulate the Sun's speed in its orbit around the galactic centre, around 230 kilometres per second. That will require a mass ratio of about 1.5.
Why? Nearly a third of the Sun's mass will be consumed. Tash was starting to feel utterly bewildered by this talk, in this context. This monumental abstraction of the manipulation of huge masses and timescales. Against the reality of the news of a bomb, news still trickling through her phone. Against the blunt protocol-breaking presence of Grace in this room, only metres from Fred Bowles. But that had always been the conceptual challenge of dealing with Galaxius, the cosmic-scale threat folding down into a petty human world. She struggled to concentrate, to ask an intelligent question. She said, a third of the mass of the Sun, Charlie. Is that bad? To deplete the Sun like that?
Actually, no, Marlowe said gently. Not necessarily, if you manage it right. Its luminosity might drop, and we may have to move the Earth closer a little bit.
Bowles had to laugh. Move the Earth a little bit? Well, that's fine then.
Marlowe shrugged calmly. Small beer compared to the rest of it, Minister.
And a smaller mass star actually lasts longer. Burns its hydrogen fuel more efficiently.
Bowles shook his head, clinging on to my sanity here. And how long would all this take?
Using up the Sun, moving the damn solar system?
Yan just smiled and raised an eyebrow at Marlowe.
Marlowe said, that much mass at that rate, say 100 million years? And we might have travelled,
wow, maybe tens of thousands of light years. She looked at Yan in some admiration. Are these the orders of magnitude of the journey you are considering? To a first approximation?
To a first approximation. You do understand, Professor.
I understand it's a hell of a stunt. That would be enough to take the Sun and Earth with it, halfway across the galaxy.
Or, Yan said evenly, out of it.
Silence.
And I suppose, Charlie said dryly, that's the point.
I feel another conceptual breakthrough coming on, said Fred Bowles. Tash, could you fetch me a glass of water?
Tash glared at Grace. Some instinct made Tash reluctant to move too far away from her. Even to move too quickly. But Grace just stared ahead, blank. Holding her secure phone, Tash went for the water.
When Tash returned from the sweet small kitchen area, with a jug and glasses for them all, Marlo glared, her arms folded.
Yan, you'd better explain your overall strategy.
Very well, said Yan placidly. Essentially, it is as I indicated. We are trying to reassure Galaxius that we are harmless. But humans, you see, are fickle creatures, all of us. Even if we made some commitment now to live constrained lives under Galaxius's not very benevolent gaze, how could we be sure that some future generation or individual despot will not decide to defy Galaxius's dictates after all and go burning up a chunk of the galactic disk in a frenzy of consumption? But our galaxy is more than the main disk. There are clusters of stars, great dense aggregations of them, suspended above and below the disk, particularly in the region of the core.
Marlo sat back, apparently marvelling.
So that's it. You're taking the Sun, Earth, and planets and all out of the galactic disk altogether.
Off to a globular cluster. And out of the reach of Galaxius, I guess you are hoping.
Bowles frowned.
I'm barely following this.
How do you know that?
If this Galaxius has spread across the galaxy, what's to have stopped it hopping up into these star clusters?
Yan sighed. We can't know for sure. Not yet. Maybe someday we will learn to detect its presence directly and its absence. But this is our intuition. Those of us who have studied Galaxius most closely, we think Galaxius will stay in the main disk. This single ocean of stars, an extrapolation of the single planetary ocean in which, we think, it first evolved.
Yes, Marlo said. That makes sense. Galaxius is a unity, physically. It won't be motivated to colonize offshore islands.
Yes, it's a fair bet it will be confined to the main disk. Something we can confirm in the distant future, if not before.
Tash said, Can I ask you, what is a globular cluster, though? What would it be like to live there?
Marlo nodded. In such a cluster, the stars swarm close, Natasha. There would be thousands more stars visible to the naked eye than in the night sky of Earth. Many of them brilliant, too. She shook her head.
So, a pretty view. A cluster may or may not be a great place for life to emerge.
The clusters evolved early. Their stars are old, and the clusters lack heavy elements.
No supernovas to trouble you, however. It may be that fewer planets per star would form than in the main disk. That lack of heavy elements.
There might be more close approaches of one star to another, so more chances for planets to become detached from their stars. But close-in worlds like Earth should be safe enough. And with all those nearby stars, it would be a great place to build a civilization, if you can avoid the light cage.
Tash smiled.
Sounds like you'd like to see it, Charlie. How many millions of years do we have to wait?
You can always dream, Tash. You can always dream.
Yan said carefully, Clusters are not ideal places for life, perhaps. But any such obstacles are preferable to extinction. And that is where we will lodge the Earth, because Galaxius will not be there.
Bowles nodded slowly. I'm picking my way through this. Let's get back to the basics. All of it. The shifting of our planet. Shifting the solar system.
or at least. This project, which is a precursor to all that, is essentially an attempt to communicate with Galaxius, correct?
Exactly. As we have said, Galaxius communicates with us, not in words or symbols, but with actions.
The blink, I got that.
Its meaning could not have been clearer, could it? So we must respond in the same way. We will tell it we will leave the galaxy. We can only tell it this by doing so. Not quickly, for we can go no faster. And besides, moving quickly, even if we could, might alarm Galaxius in any case. But we must start the process now, and visibly. So we test the components of the scheme step by step. We perfect our Acorn technology on the moon. We bring it to Mercury and begin the process of replication and launch, refining and improving as we go.
Why? The machines themselves are smart and learn. Each successive iteration of them will become more efficient, more effective.
We, our generation, will see little of the result. It will be many centuries before the great stellar rocket is even ignited, perhaps by descendants of our crude designs, massively upgraded. Thousands more years after that before the displacement becomes noticeable. But the intention will be clear, Marlowe said.
You believe. Clear to Galaxius, that is.
That's the idea. We will do all of this in full view of the Lurker, by the way, so that it sees and Galaxius sees. She frowned. At least, that was the intention. But the Lurker is gone, it seems.
Bowles put in. But what about future generations? How will they know what to do, how to carry on?
Even if they want to. That's another issue. I can't get my own nephew to eat his supper, let alone save his yet-to-be-born grandchildren.
Yan shrugged.
That is a cultural challenge, I agree. We must educate, create markers, monuments, reminders. All we, this generation, can do is set humanity on the right path to the future. She glanced at Fred. The children will have to learn to live without our guidance. Every parent understands this.
As you have brought up Xi, Tash put in gently.
Yan smiled. I didn't say it was easy.
That was when Tash's phone pinged again. Tash heard a scuffle at the door, then a loud hammering. Grace didn't move, but sat, staring forward. Fred Bowles stared at the door and at Grace, apparently confused. But Tash, relying on memories of her own minimal security training, understood and realised that what she had most feared when Grace had come in the door was unravelling. She said, "Everybody keep still. The security people have figured out we are in trouble, and I think this is being read as a hostage situation."
Bowles glared. "What the hell are you talking about? Please, Minister, just stay seated. Stay where you are. You too, Charlie, Yan." Marlowe and Yan complied, looking grim, more concerned than scared. At least they were relatively safe on the other side of the table from Grace's position, Tash realised. But everything about the layout of the room, its occupants, seemed different now and fraught with danger. "I should have acted earlier. I didn't want to believe this was happening. Damn, damn." But nobody was dead yet. She stood cautiously, picking up her phone as she did so, letting Grace see her hands at all stages. If Grace was to make a move against her, it would be now. "Grace, I need to go to the door. Is that okay?" Grace stayed still, glaring ahead at Yan, expressionless. Tash braced herself and went to the door, taking slow paces, showing her hands. By the door, she spoke into the phone, putting it on speaker.
"Who's out there?"
A gruff male voice.
"My name is Superintendent Finney, police commander on the island. Your daily code is 5926.
She looked at Fred. He nodded at her curtly. "Open the door." Tash looked over at Grace, who sat still, unmoved.
"Okay, Grace, I'll take that as consent. Superintendent, I'll open the door. On my count. 5, 4.
Grace made her move on 3. After long minutes of stillness, she stood up, knocking back her chair, and vaulted neatly over the table. And she got hold of Wu Yan, got one arm locked around her neck, and put a blade of some kind at Yan's throat.
Bowles, already standing, backed away a step. Marlow stood up, her mouth open.
"Stay still," Tash yelled. "Fred, Charlie, stay back. Stay where you are."
"Two."
"Hold, Superintendent,"
Fred called, hands in the air, taking charge.
"Things have changed in here."
"Okay, Grace.
Look, we have to let them in. Otherwise, they would just come in blasting. Is there any point to that?"
Grace met his gaze, then looked away. For 1 second, Fred kept looking at her, his disgust and dismay evident to Tash. Still, Grace didn't react. Tash wondered if she had any thought-out strategy at all, or if this desperate bit of hostage-taking was any more than a reflex. If Grace had done this thing, however hopeless, because she had no other options left. Or maybe, Tash thought, she had something against Wu Yan herself.
The officer called again. "Mr. Bowles?"
Bowles shouted back. "We have a situation in here."
He kept his eyes on Grace.
"Superintendent, come in, but carefully."
"All right, Grace?"
She didn't reply. The door opened. Two officers, armed and in armour, bustled in and stood to either side of the doorway, quickly surveying the room. The commander, Finney, followed them in. He was the man Tash had spotted on landing, who had been suspicious of her own hesitation. Bulky, 50-ish, evidently competent, tired-looking, Tash thought. Grace still stood behind Yan, with arm lock and blade at her throat. Guns were trained on Grace. Yan had closed her eyes and was breathing deeply, Tash saw.
Fred nodded. "All right, thank you for that, Grace. Superintendent?"
Finney sighed.
"Sorry to tell you this, sir. We're here to assure your safety. And we have to apprehend Grace Butterworth. It's all to do with what's going on up on the moon."
"The moon," Marlow said sadly. "At Sinus Medii. The Lurker, the Galaxius artifact, correct?"
Finney said gravely. "Destroyed, I'm afraid. By a drone missile. We're still trying to locate the source, but we know about the destination. Minister, it was guided to its target by the security signal coming out of the British monument up there."
"Ah."
Bowles looked as if he had been punched. "So they hacked into our signal, which was supposed to protect the site, the Lurker. They used it actually to guide the strike."
Finney shrugged. "No fence is more secure than the people patrolling it, sir. In this case, today's government passcode used, we aren't sure how, by Captain Harry Regent, US Air Force, and we think he got it."
"From Grace," Tash said. Memories flooded back. "Shit!"
She glanced around.
"Sorry, Fred, sir, Superintendent. I saw her do it, pass something on. When we landed here and Regent met us, I saw them shake hands, Regent and Grace."
Now Grace spoke for the first time.
"But I still needed to get your day code, Mr. Bowles."
Tash thought that over. "Right. And that's why you had to come into the room to hack the secure phone somehow. And somehow you passed it back out, the code, out from this supposedly secure room."
"That's a hole that will need to be fixed," Bowles said.
Tash said, "And I didn't report any of what I knew or suspected. I'm sorry, Fred. If you want me to resign..."
"Oh, don't be ridiculous, Tash," Bowles said.
"Half the party must have seen the same damn handshake. The coppers should have clocked it, with all due respect, Superintendent. One has to be pragmatic, and I'm going to need you more than ever in the hours and days to come, I think."
He shook his head.
"Grace, though, after all we've been through, how long we've worked together?"
Grace didn't respond.
Marlow said, "Well, I'm just bewildered. Maybe I'm naive. Why would anyone do such a thing and go to such elaborate lengths? And why the knife now, Grace?"
Fred asked softly.
"Why all this? Why threaten Wu Yan? If you think you can bargain your way out..."
Grace, stony-faced, would not answer.
Tash wondered now how she had managed to smuggle a knife into this room in the first place. A smart space supposedly proof against any such threats. Went to show how good Grace was at her job, she supposed.
Finney said, "We think we know some of it, sir. There's been quite the conspiracy."
"Just tell us, Superintendent," Bowles said, patiently enough.
Not all the details are clear yet. There are plenty of groups, including military, but not exclusively, we think, who believe we are being too soft in our response to Galaxius. That we should strike back. You have survivalists, religious fanatics, conspiracy theorists, a real cabal of doubters. But they all agreed the only thing they could strike at was the damn lurker, Marlowe said. Which is like responding to Hitler invading Poland by kicking a dachshund in Regent's Park. How bloody stupid. But very human, Tash said. I think Grace believes she lost her sister and niece because of Galaxius. Indirectly, anyhow. The Naples volcano. Grace just stood there, face blank, still holding Wu Yan, the blade. But it wasn't just the volcano, Tash said. Was it, Grace? The niece was a blink baby, which ended up with her memory being dishonored. Did you want revenge, Grace? No matter how illogical. That's what Harry Regent played on, isn't it? How he played you. Bowles growled. Oh, Butterworth, you idiot. Grace smiled back, tiredly, coldly, and finally spoke. I had motives of my own, sir. Maybe Harry will say I played him. Tash wondered how much sleep she had had recently, planning all this. But still Grace had that knife at Wu Yan's throat. Yan, in a broken whisper, said, Please, Grace, I have a child too. I will not resist. May I speak, at least? Grace didn't move. This is a tragedy, Yan whispered, even as she stood there, held by Grace. More than that, a disaster. Grace shifted her position slightly. One of the police officers stepped forward. Finny held up a hand to stop her. And Marlowe, sitting close to Yan, cautiously reached out to the Chinese scientist and held her hand. Watching Grace all the way, Grace didn't try to stop her. Marlowe asked, Why so, Yan? Why a disaster? Our fog engine project. It is meaningless unless Galaxius sees what we are doing. Or are trying to do. In fact, the demonstration of our intention is more significant in terms of the outcome than anything we have achieved so far. We have to show Galaxius we mean it. Fred, you understood that. The whole thing is really a message, in concrete terms, to send to Galaxius. Oh, Fred Bowles said, and the only eye Galaxius had open in the solar system that we know of was the Lurker, which we have now blinded. The whole point of this is communication. What will Galaxius think of us now? This is epochal, an existential disaster. She said these words, Tash saw, even as a little blood seeped out from the skin of her neck through Grace's gloved fingers. No, Charlie Marlowe said firmly, and Tash could see an idea being worked through even as she spoke. No, it isn't true. I mean, the moon isn't the only location in the solar system where humans face a Galaxius artifact. Not anymore. Your own son, Yan. He's there. Tash said eagerly, Of course. Pioneer 14, at the anti-sun. We have a crewed ship sitting there, faced by that weird object, your son. Yan sounded faintly bewildered. Yes, that is true. But we have no evidence of observing stations out there. Equivalents of the lurkers. Galaxius is going to know we are there, Marlowe said confidently. I bet its installations out there are covered in lurkers, or the equivalent, sending reports up to that interstellar messaging network. And if that's so, Tash said eagerly, you can tell Galaxius your whole story through packets sent up from Earth, relayed by the Pioneer crew, by Xi himself, by your son. We can't bring back the Lurker, and let's hope we don't get punished for that. But we can keep talking. Keep showing Galaxius your good stuff, Yan. Keep getting your message through. We are no threat to you. Look, we're leaving the damn galaxy. Tash stole a glance at the three coppers in the room, who looked utterly baffled by this talk. Grace and Yan were still frozen in their lethal tableau. But Marlowe was enthused. This is your vindication, Fred. For all the times you tried to bring China and the West together to talk, mother and son, even. Because now we have to work together. Yanhir and her son up on the Pioneer. They have to talk. She shook her head, apparently marvelling.
You were right.
Fred Bowles shook his head. Well, I'll put the knighthood on hold for now. Grace, come on, end this.
Grace said, or hissed,
Galaxias killed my niece. You want to appease it. Collaborators.
And, with a spasm-like plunge, she drove her blade into Yan's neck. The police had Grace on the ground in a second. The superintendent caught Yan and lowered her stiff body into a chair. Tash was astonished by the amount of blood, vivid red, that spilled on the floor.